On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The White House does not want to call it a civil war. But at a certain point, the political spin doctors do not get the last word. The death tolls are through the roof. Sunni and Shiite militias are slugging it out with exploding sophistication and lethality. President Bush said today it's a lot of sectarian violence provoked by al-Qaeda. Does that mean it's not a civil war? Prominent military historians now put it this way. American troops in Iraq are now in the middle of one of the world's bloodiest civil wars in half a century. It will likely go on for years until one side wins. And the United States has choices to make. Up next on Point, civil war and Iraq. In a moment, we'll hear from two experts on civil wars past and present. We will also hear in this hour from correspondents Anthony Shadid in the Middle East and Robin Wright in Washington. But we go first to Baghdad, where we're joined by Time Magazine Bureau Chief Bobby Ghosh. Bobby Ghosh, thanks very much for being with us. You had 3,700-plus Iraqis killed in October, more than 100,000 a month fleeing now to Syria and Jordan, 500-plus since Thanksgiving Day last week. Bobby, are you covering a civil war?
Hi, Tom. Yes, by almost any definition of the term, this is a civil war. I know that there is a debate in Washington about the phrasing of it and whether or not it is a good idea to call it that, but I can tell you that if you ask anybody in Iraq outside the protected bubble of the Green Zone, they would tell you that it is a civil war and it has been for several months now. When you have a situation where more than 100 people are being killed every day for no other reason than because they belong to one or other sect of Islam, It looks like, smells like, and it is a civil war.
Bobby, let's go to the nuance that the president is insisting on keeping here. He said today on the road that this is a lot of sectarian violence and that it's being provoked by al-Qaeda. The implication there that this is not taken on a life of its own, it's still being stoked by al-Qaeda. If we could just root out this al-Qaeda element, this would go away. Does that add up with reality as you see it?
Not quite. That was certainly true, I would say, last year and in the early part of this year. There's no question that al-Qaeda was responsible for stoking this. But I think the train has now left the station. And although al-Qaeda remains a major element in the civil war, it has taken on a horrible logic of its own. You have now Shiite militias who are conducting campaigns of that amount essentially to ethnic cleansing in large parts of the country. They may have been provoked a year ago by al-Qaeda, but at this point they are working on their own steam.
Is this a debate that's just in the USA? Is it significant to Iraqis? Do they debate whether or not it's a civil war, or are they past that? Where's their perspective?
I think they're long past it. Iraqis who have to live in the war, which is to say people who live outside of the green zone of Baghdad, have long since concluded that it is a civil war, and they are, if you like, voting with their feet. As you pointed out, hundreds of thousands are streaming out of this country. There are more than a million Iraqi refugees in Jordan, a similar number in Syria. There are large numbers in Egypt and other parts of the Middle East. Almost anybody in this country who can afford to or who has a degree or qualification of some kind that would give them a job elsewhere in the world is leaving the country.
And Bobby, finally, the U.S. is still pinning its hopes on some kind of accommodation to be reached between Shiites and Sunnis that would permit this to simmer down. Do Iraqis still see that as a possibility, or do they now look at it and say one side has to win, whatever that means?
Well, most Iraqis are moderates in this fight. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that it is still, at this point, mostly the extremists on both sides that are responsible for most of the violence. Most Iraqis would like to see some sort of accommodation reached. Unfortunately, the political leadership and the religious leadership in this country has so far been unable to reach that accommodation. There are very few leaders of any vision. Very few leaders who can look past their narrow interests. And so that is a huge complicating factor in any plans for Iraq in the future.
And here we are in the bloody world. Bobby Ghosh in Baghdad, thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime, Tom.
Bobby Ghosh, Baghdad bureau chief for Time Magazine. He spoke with us from Baghdad. Joining me now from Palo Alto, California, is James Fearon, professor of political science at Stanford and an expert on the causes of civil war and ethnic violence. In September, he testified on what he already then called a civil war in Iraq before a House committee. He's at work on a book on civil war since 1945. James Fearon, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from New Haven, Connecticut, Nicholas Sambanis, professor of political science at Yale, co-editor of two volumes on the study of civil war entitled Understanding Civil War. His new book is Making War and Building Peace. Nicholas Sambanis, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom.
James Fearon, in a nutshell, what did you tell the House committee in September?
Basically, the current political objectives for Iraq that the Bush administration are trying to bring about are unrealistic. The idea that we will be able to help put together a stable power-sharing agreement that will hold after we depart is basically unrealistic, and that means that kind of any military strategy we pursue is likely to fail. And that's basically because things have advanced in Iraq to the point where we have a quite serious civil war, and the historical evidence suggests that power sharing, you know, civil wars rarely end with stable power sharing agreements, but tend to end pretty much overwhelmingly with decisive military victories.
We'll look at how civil wars end. Nicholas Sambanis, let me get you just on the record here. You wrote the book, or edited it, Understanding Civil War. Do you see this as clearly a civil war? Is that now the consensus of military historians and observers?
Well, I'm not sure if it's the consensus of all observers, but I certainly see this as a civil war. It meets all the criteria that are commonly used in political science. And these criteria are essentially that the conflict involved the government fighting against domestic groups seeking control of the state or independence or change in government policy, and that the fighting caused excessive numbers of deaths above some threshold, usually 1,000 in a year. And Iraq far surpasses that threshold. In fact, deaths in Iraq have already surpassed the median number of deaths in all civil wars since 1945.
James Fearon, I want to look at your vision of the future, but we kind of need to understand where we've come from here. There's been first such resistance to calling what was in Iraq an insurgency, and then and now great resistance in the White House to calling this a civil war. In your study of civil war, is that typical? Do powers or third-party powers typically want to deny it, or is this something unique about the Iraq conflict and the U.S. role there?
I'd say it's not unique. It's typical for governments that are facing particularly separatist groups to not want to call it a civil war, which they view as, you know, it would legitimize the rebels or the insurgents in some way. They tend to want to call them criminals or bandits. So you have cases like, I mean, there are a lot of examples of this, but you'll have cases like Colombia where for many years, Colombians, and especially the government, you know, did not want to dignify the FARC by calling them, you know, referring to what was going on in the Civil War. So that's pretty typical. What's a little odd in this case is the way it's played out in the U.S. And U.S. media and the back and forth with the administration. You know, if we weren't involved in Iraq, or if, you know, if this was a conflict, if we had the same conflict going on somewhere else, but we weren't involved with it, the U.S. media would have no trouble whatsoever referring to this as a civil war, and you know, no one would really care. But it's, you know, it's because we're involved, and because the it's become a politicized issue where, you know, as soon as or if the administration ever says yes, we agree there's a civil war now in Iraq, they're going to see headlines the next day saying Bush administration admits it's a civil war, and it will play very badly for them. So I think they're kind of locked into this awkward position now, where, as you know, things have advanced more and more on the ground, and you know, it's harder and harder to, you know, deny what Iraqis have come to view as the reality of civil war. the administration's kind of stuck in a difficult spot given where they previously committed themselves.
And now we may see a reality overwhelming that resistance in the headlines. It's there now, NBC using it and many others now just picking it up. Nicholas Sambanis, has the public conversation and debate about this war in the United States been hampered, retarded by unwillingness to call it like it is?
I think it probably has, to the extent that the American public doesn't fully realize what's in store for them and for American troops in Iraq and for the American government. Calling it an insurgency implies that it's a more manageable problem than it actually is and that it might end soon. But violence that reaches these levels doesn't just go away.
We're talking this hour about civil war and Iraq. We're joined by Nicholas Sambanis at Yale, James Ferron at Stanford. This morning, speaking in Tallinn, Estonia, President Bush linked recent violence to sectarian tensions, not civil war.
The Samara bombing that took place last winter was intended to create sectarian violence, and it has. The recent bombings were to perpetuate the sectarian violence. In other words, we've been in this phase for a while. And the fundamental objective is to work with the Iraqis to create conditions so that the vast majority of the people will be able to see that there's a peaceful way forward.
President Bush, this morning, on the road, commenting on whether or not this is a civil war. James Ferron, you've looked at civil war since 1945. If this is indeed a civil war, what about this hope of creating conditions so that we can pull out a peaceful way forward here?
I think it's quite unrealistic at this point. If you look historically, only about one in six civil wars ends with a power-sharing agreement. And even, I'd say even that is kind of a generous attribution for power-sharing agreements. Even some of those are really military victories in which the winner gives some small concessions to the loser. Power, and that's exactly what we're trying to do, of course, which is to get a power-sharing agreement between Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish factions in a democratic framework. The problem is fighting has undermined the trust so much between these groups, and in addition, in Iraq, you've got such a factionalized, the Shia, the Sunnis, are so factionalized internally that just makes putting a stable power sharing deal together extremely difficult.
So how do civil wars tend to end?
They tend to end with decisive victories, at least in particular civil wars where the parties are fighting for control of the central government. That's about 3 out of 4 cases. Whether this is going to be such a case, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is the historical pattern suggests that, eventually we'll see a consolidation on one side or another, or one particular faction will get particularly strong and win. But actually, looking at the specific circumstances of Iraq, I wouldn't be surprised to see a very long stalemate. The fighting could go on for a very long time, as it did in Lebanon, or as I've heard some people refer to it, Iraq is like Somalia with oil.
You testified before Congress that civil wars in the last half century or so have tended to last a decade.
The average length is around a decade, and with about half or the median ending within 7 years and half ending in more than 7 years.
And what about the U.S. presence in the middle of a civil war? What can U.S. troops do if that's what we've got here now? What's the utility?
Well, I think, that's probably one of the reasons why the administration is doesn't really want to describe this as a civil war, is that immediately raises the question of, well, what is the military mission of U.S. troops there? And I'm sure they're worried that this would increase public pressure for leaving.
Should the U.S., Nicholas Sambanis, if it's civil war, if it's civil war, and the record shows that it very rarely happens that parties to a civil war work it out, come to an accommodation, does that mean that the United States has to pick a winner?
Well, the United States already has picked sides, right? It's siding with the government and moderates.
What would you say? Not a complete alliance. They have pressed Maliki's government to come to some accommodations with the Sunni rather than just stomping them down.
Yes. Well, the historical pattern shows that when parties that are fighting civil war receive assistance, all parties receive assistance from external actors, like in this case the United States or regional neighboring states in Iraq, then the wars actually tend to last much, much longer. And they can only end when there is a concerted effort by all of the interested parties in the region to end it. So in Cambodia, for example, a very long and bloody civil war, one of the bloodiest in the world since 1945, ended when regional powers were able to agree and brought all of the parties to a table, including the Khmer Rouge. Right? So it has to be some sort of effort to bring even the radical elements to the table, but that, of course, makes agreement more difficult.
James Fearon, with your experience in looking at civil wars, then what about the options that we've been have been described to us? Ramping up, staying the course, pulling out? How do you view each of those in terms of the historical record?
Well, I think that ramping up and staying the course, as I said earlier, the odds that the basic objective that the administration now has can be achieved, I think, are low enough that at a minimum we need to plan for an alternative. And that, you know, I guess I see it as there's not a whole lot we can do at this point unless we were going to, you know, put in 500,000 troops, or which is, you know, politically seems too unrealistic on our side.
And so, even if that was done, I believe you testified that there's no guarantee of success with that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, you know, even if we could bring things to, you know, quiet things down and, you know, get rid of the violence in Baghdad, I was arguing that we'd likely face the same kind of problems once we tried to exit, even if that was in five more years.
So a ramp up doesn't look good. Stay the course. We see where that has us. What about withdrawal?
Well, that was what I was arguing. You know, that's pretty much what you're left with. Since the status quo doesn't really seem tenable, it seems to me that one way of putting the problem is that you've got some Sunni groups that really believe that if we leave, or even if we don't, they may be able to take power back, and you've got Shia groups who think there's no way they're going to let that happen, and basically they're going to have to fight it out for a while to figure out what the real military balance is, and hopefully. That would lead to them to, hopefully, but regrettably, that might lead them back to a similar point where they decide, well, we really are stalemated. We need to cut some kind of a deal.
But you've described something shy of just letting the forest fire burn. As I read your testimony, it looked as if you're saying, don't be too precipitous, too quick in your withdrawal. Stick around and help these neighborhoods get sorted out so you don't have mass-scale ethnic cleansing meltdown.
Yeah, I was arguing against a really sudden or really quick withdrawal, at least in September, because I was worried that that would lead to a very sudden, rapid escalation of breakdown of the central government, possibly splintering of the army, and sudden campaigns of more severe ethnic cleansing. I thought that a more gradual approach would allow people to sort themselves out on the ground. As time passes, however, and the violence continues to escalate, and people vote with their feet, I think the force of that argument is gradually diminishing.
Meaning what? That the U.S. might as well withdraw, or it should still hang in to try and sort of be traffic cops to minimize the death before it goes or as it goes.
When I read news reports, we often hear these days that. There's horrendous violence happening, and what are the U.S. troops doing? They're basically watching it. It's not really clear what our military mission is there right now or what our troops are being asked to do within the violence. I think, you have to ask, it's not clear to me at this point that we are having a big effect on the levels of sectarian violence that are going on. Possibly the only thing our troops are really doing at this point are keeping essentially our presence is keeping the Green Zone government together.
And that change, in your impressions at least, just since September. John is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Enjoying your show. Since from the beginning of this conflict and the very onset of this conflict, and the United States and all the allies, they're doggedly insisting on talking about integrating the whole country. where the people in that country who have widely differences, you know, most of them are from different religion, I guess, maybe different religion.
John, we can't hear you much, so what are you saying? Let it split up?
I mean, why the United States is likely insisting on this? I mean, it's something that is like a utopic notion that would be impossible.
Utopic to hold Iraq together, but surely we didn't go there just to split it up. But let us pick that up. Nicholas Sambanis, what about it? The notion of a unified Iraq, is that something the United States should have let go? Does it let it go now if it concedes there's a civil war and withdraws? Or do the Shia go in and do they? I mean, we see the report in the Washington Post today saying that an internal Marine Corps study says the U.S. is losing in Anbar. Could the Shia go into Anbar and mop up the Sunni there? Or what do you say?
I would say that, unfortunately, at this point, I don't see how any of the three alternatives that you and Jim discussed would have any effect on the sort of in the short run. I see an escalation of violence in the short run in Iraq. And partition, which the caller seems to favor, may be a solution that will eventually happen. I mean, it is happening sort of on the ground, sort of as we speak, effectively. But I don't think the avoidance of partition is just a desire of the United States. Certainly, neighboring states in Iraq do not want to see this happening. And we have to remember that an assumption underlying the argument that partition would work is that the cleavages that we observe now as salient and driving the conflict, the sectarian cleavages, that is, are the only ones that matter, really. But in fact, what happens when countries split up into new countries that are either de facto or de jure independent, new cleavages emerge and new conflicts can occur and they can turn violent, right? So it's quite likely that we could see intra-Shiite or intra-Kurdish fighting in the case of a partition as well. So I don't think partition is the magic bullet in this case.
Mm. Let's go to Largo, Maryland, and Balaji. Hi, Balaji, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm actually thinking that a lot of options are actually put on the table and not actually visible options. And if I'm understanding, I know history never repeats itself, but government and people actually are the ones that actually repeat the foolishness and stupidity of history. And that's why we have a mess in Iraq. And if we actually fail to identify this as a civil war, then we're in for a very big mess. Because a problem that is identified is a problem half solved. But if the government of the United States refused to identify the problem as a civil war, then we are in for a very long wave of crisis. What we need to do is actually identify this is a civil war. Look at histories of other countries that have actually undergone civil war, and through that, actually see ways in which those civil wars were actually brought to a conclusion and see what can be brought to Iraq.
Well, we've got some great experts with us to do just that. Let's try it. James Farron, you were saying in September, stick around and help work this out. Now you're saying maybe it's too late for that. If the U.S. withdraws and if we've got a civil war here, looking through the prism of history, what do you anticipate in this conflict? What kind of trail ahead?
I think that, you know, the dice have been thrown and we wouldn't know exactly how they'd come down. There's a lot of uncertainty. My best guess would be that a Shia government would not be able to, you know, crush, even with the help of Iran, the insurgency in the western provinces in Anbar, and that you'd get something of a stalemate. I'm increasingly wondering if the divisions on the Shiite side might actually provide an opening for the Sunni insurgent groups to retake power.
You think the divisions among the Shia are that deep and with Iran behind them that they would ever let the Sunni retake power?
Yes. I think that could be.
Wow.
The divisions among the Shia are very, very deep. And this is something that's not, I think, been made as clear as it ought to be in the reporting of the conflict.
Describe what you see there. Muqtada al-Sadr is described as very powerful, and Prime Minister Maliki is sort of beholden to him. Where's the cleavage?
Well, there's multiple groups. So Maliki is technically part of a party called Dawa, But that was really, it's not even clear in what sense it's a party. It's really a set of factions, three main kind of tendencies within it. Then you've got Skiri, a party that has the, you know, historically strongest ties with Iran. And then you've got the Sadrists, which is itself, so you've got Muqtada al-Sadr as, kind of technically the head of this, but it's really how much actual control he exerts over these gangs, essentially, that go around wearing black and some of them committing a lot of violent crimes.
But now we're reading reports already that Iran, perhaps through Hezbollah, is in there training Shia militias now. If the Sunni began to make gains on the Shia majority, military gains, in a civil war, do you not expect Iran would take steps, with its bitter history of war with a Sunni-dominated Iraq, would it not take steps to ally with the Shia and cement their grip on power?
Well, how would they, you know, is there a, you know, the, you say the Shia, like who would they ally with? Would they pick one group? Would they continue to try to do what they're doing now, which is kind of keep ties with all three? I mean, I guess it looks like Skiri is their favorite. But yeah, you know, it could be that, you know, as I was saying, I guess my best guess would be stalemate. But I wouldn't be surprised to see essentially a war among the Shia groups. Remember, you think about the Lebanon analogy. On the surface, that looked very much like Christians versus Muslims, or Christians versus Sunnis versus Shias. But there was really as much fighting within each of those confessions as across them.
And do you mean stalemate in a conflict, or stalemate that might actually lead to a kind of de facto partition and peace?
I think a de facto partition someday is certainly a possibility, although it's a little hard to see in given the geography of Iraq, how you get stable defensible lines through so much desert. I would expect that, you know, if a partition involved cutting the Sunni out of all the oil revenues, we would just continue to see Sunni insurgent groups attacking across whatever the de facto partition lines were, and the war wouldn't end.
I want to turn right now to Beirut, Lebanon, and Anthony Shadid, correspondent for The Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner for his coverage of the war in Iraq. He was last in Iraq in October. Anthony Shadid, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Anthony, you have written that it's too tidy to call what's going on in Iraq a civil war. Does that mean that it's better or worse than civil war?
Well, it felt to me, to be honest, to be worse than civil war. I was there in October, and I have to say the situation on the ground felt to me it was worse than I expected, in all honesty. You know, civil war, I think, suggests what you might have seen in Lebanon, for instance, in the 1970s and 1980s, a conflict where you understood the fault lines, or at least where the fault lines were discernible. And what I saw in Baghdad was a conflict that felt felt even more chaotic than a civil war might. There were so many different fault lines, so many different contests and confrontations going on at the same time that I found it almost impossible to try to describe in one simple phrase or in a few words.
And yet, for Americans trying to make sense of what's going on, to figure out where to put their individual weight as citizens here, what we call it and how we understand it is important. So what do you say to Americans trying to figure out what path to support?
Well, I don't know. I tell you, as a journalist, it's hard to predict what to do or what the best option ahead is. I have to say, just as a person visiting there, a person seeing what the situation was like, I don't know what the path would be, to be completely honest, or if there is a path at this point. I mean, we've seen such a fundamental restructuring of Iraqi society in a way since the U.S. invasion. I mean, these forces that were unleashed 3 years ago have remade the country in so many respects, and these forces are still playing themselves out. I mean, it's almost been kind of it's almost a relentless kind of arc that's played out since 2003. And what we're seeing at this point is entropy, is a certain disintegration. And I guess to ask what path to follow, what answer there is, I wouldn't know at this point.
There's a big question mark. We've got questions from callers for you, Anthony Shadid. Mark is calling from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well.
Yesterday, our involvement in this war exceeded finally our involvement in World War II, and maybe
in duration. Yes, indeed.
Right, maybe that's what broke the logjam, and NBC came out and called this a civil war. My question really is to the press, Mr. Shadid and others, and that is my frustration with the way the press has reported from the buildup to the war through the present phase. The public depends on the press to call things the way they are. And in this particular case, I think it's long overdue. The administration has gotten away with characterizing this conflict from before, during, and now in this phase. And the press hasn't felt, I guess, strong enough or willing enough to confront them. And I'd like to know why that is. And let me just give you one example with a quote from George Bush, in which he said it's not a civil war because the voters in Iraq went to the polls
right.
and elected a government. And I mean, that's just lunacy because, of course, in 1860, Americans went to the polls and elected a government, and it led directly to the civil war. It was the cause of the secession.
Mark, we hear the complaint, and let us pick it up. Tony Shadid, I'll give that to you, though I'm not walking away from some responsibility there as well. But how do you respond to Citizen Mark, who wants to know, where has the press been in insisting on an accurate representation of these events?
Well, I mean, I have to say, the criticisms of our, you know, of our role in Iraq are fair. I don't think we've done it perfectly by any means, and I think that's particularly the case with the run-up to the war. I think you often do see two narratives coming out of journalism when we're talking about the situation in Iraq. I think you see a certain narrative that is written in Washington, and you see another narrative that's written on the ground in Baghdad. And I have to say, I think, you know, while we've made mistakes, while we've gotten things wrong, I'm pretty proud of the reporting that we've done on the ground in Baghdad over the past 3 years. I thought we were pretty sober from the start about where this was headed. Often, there's a great deal of criticism from the CPA, for instance, back then, and then later when the State Department took over the operation in Iraq. I mean, did we see those forces that we're dealing with now back in 2003? I think we did. But, you know, the caller makes a perfectly legitimate point, and it isn't the final word. Some stories could have definitely been done better. It's always a question of access. It's a question of, being able to pursue the stories you want to pursue. And Baghdad is, I have to say, Baghdad and Iraq, for that matter, the rest of Iraq, it's one of the most perilous places I've ever reported as a journalist. And, you know, we haven't done the job, as perfectly as we would all wanted to do.
Anthony Shadid in Beirut, Pulitzer Prize winner for his coverage of the war in Iraq, author of Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadows of America's War. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Sambanis, James Friend, let me put to you, today in the New York Times, we've got Dominic Johnson at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton and Dominic Tierney at Swarthmore talking about what they call the wars of perception. They look back at the Tet Offensive and Somalia, saying Americans decided too quickly that they had failed. They say be careful of grasping acceptance of failure too quickly in Iraq. What do you say to that, James Friend? Is that the greater threat here?
Well, you know, every case is different, and it's conceivable that if we, you know, tough it out or, you know, massively increase our troop presence, then in some period of time, you know, almost surely a long period of time, 5-10 years, you know, things could settle down. But, you know, you can only go on, you have to make estimates here because it's, you know, we're working with a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, I think, you know, looking at similar cases and historical experience, you have to estimate the likelihood as low. Iraq looks like a tougher case to me than a much tougher case than Bosnia, where they'd already fought to a stalemate by the time that NATO started bombing and the Dayton agreements were put in place. And essentially the international community is still guaranteeing peace in Bosnia more than 10 years later. Iraq to me looks like a much tougher case, and we'd be getting shot at for, you know, the whole time we're there.
Nicholas Sambanis, what about it? The president's essentially still saying, let's tough it out. We'll see what the Iraq Study Group has to say. These two authors, the two Dominics here, say, be careful that you don't perceive failure too quickly. What do you say to that?
Well, I think to respond fully to this, we would have to have a sort of a clear statement of what the goals of the administration are now, as opposed to what they were right after the invasion, and how they've been modified as a result of the violence, right? So I think if the goal is to establish a stable democracy with some kind of a power-sharing agreement, and a country that doesn't pose threats to its neighbors, then the American public should be prepared to stay in Iraq for a decade or more. And even then, things would be looking good. So most countries that have civil wars and are able to end their civil wars after many years of fighting are not democracies within 5 or even 10 years. Yeah, so that's just the reality of the historical record so far. And Iraq does seem to be much more complicated and much more fractionalized society than Bosnia or other examples that people use to analyze this case.
Let me turn to Washington for a moment and Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
You're writing today with Tom Rex about a kind of galvanizing sense of urgency, but galvanizing toward what? And describe what you're seeing there. Saudi Arabia, you say, essentially summoning Dick Cheney to say to him over the weekend, what the heck's going on here?
Well, I think there's growing concern throughout the Middle East about the danger not only of civil war in Lebanon, but the spillover effect throughout the region, destabilizing relations between Sunni and Shiites, and basically becoming a flashpoint for a lot of conflagrations in the region, in the way Lebanon was in the 1970s and 1980s. The Saudis did summon a vice president, wanted to have a conversation with him about Iraq, and its links as well to the other conflicts, whether it's Lebanon, the Arab-Israeli conflict, or the issue of Iran's nuclear program.
The King of Jordan recently warning that he fears the possibility of 3 civil wars, as he described them, in Iraq, in Lebanon, and Palestinians and Israelis all at once. Are people talking about a risk of, as you're kind of describing it, regional meltdown here?
It's regional meltdown. I think there's a sense of growing kind of diplomatic panic about the scope of this, that it's gone beyond the ability of the administration to control. No one's talking about Iraq as a model for democracy throughout the region. It's focused on damage control. The White House review is basically looking at the next 2 years, what it can achieve, both for the president's legacy and given that this is likely to be a long-term problem, what it can do in just 2 years.
You report this morning senior U.S. intelligence officials saying that the situation now requires that the Bush administration abandon its long-held goal of national reconciliation and instead pick a winner. What would that mean?
Well, it kind of means take sides, but remember this is one voice within the intelligence community, and I think one of the striking things is the diversity of opinion in Washington today. It's one of the reasons you see the Iraq Study Group having intense deliberations yesterday and today over its report expected to come out in the next couple of weeks. There have been deep divisions among members on the panel, both Republicans and Democrats. And from what I understand, the White House review has led to some heated discussions. I'm not sure angry, but heated discussions about what's really possible.
But at the moment, something like, as you say, diplomatic panic. Robin Wright, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Robin Wright of the Washington Post, diplomatic correspondent there. John's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to make a couple of points and have your guest respond to them. Incredible as it may sound, the problem that the United States has is even much worse than that of Iraq. That's just a piece of it. What we have now is a completely delusional administration and incompetent to boot. I mean, you get statements like mission accomplished 3 years ago. High-level people in the White House make statements like reality is what we say it is. Most of Iraq, the people in Iraq look at the Maliki government as essentially a puppet government set up by the United States. And for 3 years, nobody's been willing in the press or otherwise to say the emperor isn't wearing any clothes, this media, whatever. And the real problem is I don't see how the United States can any way, shape, or form add to the solution of this problem with the people who are running the country right now.
Of course, but we just had a change in Congress. There could be a change in the White House. Who knows? But let us look at it. James Fearon, here's a very sweeping charge that you've got, an administration who says we're not part of the reality-based crew. John calls the administration delusional. You could debate that, but what does history say, again, when countries get into this much trouble about coming to grips with reality, and where do you see the U.S. in that process?
It's a tough question. I guess I think that things have gotten to the point where even if you had a very different administration, if all of us, you know, we could magically switch the people running foreign policy, you know, the options have narrowed to the point, and events have moved on the ground so far that it's not clear that we really have, that our ability to control or greatly influence events on the ground is that great. So, you know, whatever one thinks about the quality of the decisions and the, you know, whether they were delusional or in a state of denial and so on, you know, to looking forward, you know, I'm not so sure that there, it's an issue of like, well, if we could just get the right, you know, people who were more competent in there, things would change. I think our options have really narrowed.
So we came in a dream, we may go in a dream, but we just heard Robin Wright, Nicholas Sambanis say that people in the region are sort of freaking out, diplomatic panic, she called it, about what this all may portend. I mean, can a superpower really swan in and swan out that way after all those hundreds of billions in lives? Aren't there real interests here?
There are, of course, real interests, and the caller who made this point made an interesting argument about, well, he commented on a idea that the United States should basically pick a winner, and there is an argument out there that to actually end civil wars that are as complicated as Iraq, one should pick a winner, and the winner is usually the stronger side, right? But even our conversation today suggests that it's not actually clear exactly which is the stronger side, particularly if we consider the alliances that the parties in Iraq have with neighboring countries, right? So first thing that needs to be done is to sort out what is the consensus in the region over sort of a viable future for Iraq, and something that Syria and Iran can live with, and they can cooperate with the United States in trying to implement this policy. Unfortunately, there is evidence that rather than having increased sort of regional consensus and coordination, you have increasing conflict, right, at least between Iran and the United States. So a regional strategy for Iraq seems difficult to achieve at this point.
James Fearon, our time grows short, just a couple of minutes here. You've looked back on civil wars across half a century and more. It's too early to say definitively, but with your experience, how do you guess historians will look back on this U.S. involvement in what has at this point, we're hearing today, become fully a civil war?
How do I think historians will look back on it?
Yeah.
As a complete debacle. You know, I think in a way the Bush administration has, you know, partially intentionally but mainly unintentionally, it's like they've thrown a pack of cards up in the air in the Middle East. And, you know, things are going to, it's going to have, probably going to have just huge effects, the kind of regional effects that you were just talking about. And we really don't know what they're going to be. But this is really going to remake, there's a good likelihood this is really going to remake the Middle East. And that we're entering a period of a lot of instability and potentially a lot of violence even outside Iraq. And you know, kind of where it's going to shake out, we really don't know. But I think that the historians, when they look at the decision making that went into this, will say they really went in with too much ignorance and too much arrogance.
It singes the eyes and singes the ears, but we're hearing it. James Fearon at Stanford, thank you very much for being with us today. Your earlier testimony and your time today, we're very grateful for. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Sambanis, professor of political science at Yale. Professor Sambanis, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.